two of these people aren't here. Did they come Thursday?
We have six people registered, but there are people will trickle in probably.
Okay, well,
there are a couple more will trickle in probably.
Okay, fair enough. First, I've come back from Vienna with a terrible cough, not a cold. I won't be sneezing. At some point during the lecture, I just might break down in what sounds like a death watch. It's not. I just take a cold, but I'll be quiet for a minute or so.
How many days have you had the cold?
Four. It's not a cold.
So you should not be infectious now.
No, no. And there's also water here, which I may need to refill. The website has changed. You've got Joe Felsenstein's two lectures from last week, number two and number three, in that order by accident. And you've got all the rest of my handout, which is 200-page chapter five that I promised you. Everything you need to know about morphometrics, not counting the multivariate analysis, which is in chapter four, which we will get to out of order, wherever that is. Yeah, so chapter four was posted on the web before the course started. It'll be our lectures of lectures of next Tuesday and then November 8th. So they're widely separated because they're kind of painful. You have to go through this stuff once and it has formulas. Okay, so that's the website, but I would recommend that you review Joe's lectures. They're charming and very good diagrams, and that you go over my textbook, partly because it's a draft textbook, it hasn't been published yet, and so if there are things in there that strike you as absurd, or typographical errors, or just nonsense, now's a good time to let me know. In terms of the stuff that I talked to you about before my trip, there's been one addition in Chapter 3, the thing called the Akaiki Information Criterion. There's now four pages about that. That wasn't there before.
I'll correct you. Akaika.
Thank you.
Not Akaika.
Okay, well, Akaika.
I'm just being
okay,
obnoxious.
In any case, it's a general statistical tool for comparing models that have different numbers of parameters on the same for the same prediction. And if any of you want it, let me know, and I'll get you that alteration of the file. But it's a kind of specialized device. I would have talked about it because we were talking about multiple regression, and it's a useful thing to know if you're doing multiple regression or looking for quadratic terms. Okay, so that's that. The file, the participants. Hello. Just quick here. There are three new things on the class website, one of which is my notes for the rest of most of the rest of my lectures. Okay, so let's go here to chapter five, and I'll be going much more slowly for the rest of the course than I was before. This is a 200-page chapter, which will take five of our class sessions. And then chapter four is an 80-page chapter, which will take the other two of the sessions in the middle. And I will occasionally jump back and forth with new figures as well. So we want to start with a kind of a characterization here. The stuff I'm going to be talking about really is squarely on the border between geometry and biology. Biology here is meant as a house of many rooms. It includes agriculture, it includes animal husbandry, it includes genomics, phylogenetics, everything Joe talks about, everything I talk about, most of the stuff that medical school talks about. But geometry is its own... You did okay. I remain plugged in. Thank you. Good.
You're fine.
I'm fine. But it's meant somehow as being attached to the natural sciences, and the geometry, the part that's coming in here, isn't that kind of information. Geometry comes in as theorems, and methods, and tools like circles and straight lines. So it's not meant here as a science. It's meant as a way of thinking about things. And this is a problem, the numerical description of biological organisms, that has been around for a long time, roughly 30,000 years since the first cave paintings, because paintings are patterns on a wall and animals aren't. And if you go, oh, I meant to do this before, let me just grab it. Let's try, let's go. You can you take a typical cave painting here like that. This is from the cave at Lascaux, and clearly someone is trying to do morphometrics here. There are good representations of animals, sometimes in gallop, sometimes charging, sometimes just sitting quietly and getting shot with arrows. Let me say, this was painted 30,000 years ago by people who basically didn't understand anything about numbers. Probably numbers had not been invented. But conceptions of form had been invented. And the difference between these antlers and these antlers, probably that's a male, and probably that's a female, and it looked like they're not shooting the male, because he'd get angry. They're shooting the females. They got this one. So, back at the dawn of archaeology, there are already attempts to make a representation of form, and often those representations are numerical. It's kind of an accident of 20th century and 21st century biology that the numbers work as well as they do. And where we're going in this chapter is to consistently compare two quite different kinds of images. Just to jump ahead one page, this is figure 5.1. That's the one kind of image. It's a form. We'll talk in some detail about what kind of representation it is. And this is the second kind of representation. This is a relation between forms. You can think of this, if you want, from last week as a contrast. It's not a really bad equivalence. The picture here isn't quite the image of a contrast, but this is like Joe's contrast. It's also like a genetic distance. It will turn out that this will be representable as a McCruskey's distance. But these are different kinds of metaphors for the representation of the information in science. This, of course, isn't a photograph. It's a laser scan, a scan of the distance from this organism to an instrument, the camera. And anybody who's ever babysat or has a child knows this image isn't a still image. That child is squirming, which is an interesting problem because it means it's not posing for you. It's quite hard to measure that image, which is called in the text your basic biostereometric baby. These contours of distance from the camera of a forward-facing surface of a squirming organism. And there are probably several million bytes of information in the original image. There are several tens of thousands, even in these traced contours. But it will turn out to be very difficult for us to put landmark points on this without a great deal of work. Maybe this is the elbow of this arm, but we can't even see the elbow of this arm, as a point, I mean. The baby has fingers, but the fist is clenched. They're not showing. It has toes, and the toes are kind of showing, except these are occluded. So we got a big toe, and the foot is very foreshortened. If you had it in 3D, you could probably see the length of the foot. There's a kind of soft tissue knee here, soft tissue knee here, a tummy here, which isn't at the, what's the scientific name of the belly button? I've forgotten it. What's this point called? I'm blocking.
Okay.
Not abdomen.
So I can't hear.
Abdomen?
So no, I'm talking about the point where, navel, thank you. The navel, that's not the navel. There's the navel down there. This is just the tummy. The heart's in here. The lungs are in here. This isn't anything, this wonderful landmark here at the point of the forehead closest to the camera. It would be nice if that was what we call the boss of the forehead, except there are two of them. It points where the curvature is greatest on the forehead, one on either side. It's not on the midline. So you see some landmarks that are fake, some landmarks that are kind of real, like the tip of the nose, some structures. We'll be talking some about faces later today. But this, by itself, is much more frustrating as an image than it is useful as an image for any biological or even cognitive purpose. At the same time, I'd like to think you all instantly recognize this as a human baby. So the way you recognized it wasn't the way a biologist recognizes something. It's not yet like those paintings on the Lascaux wall. It's not yet remotely metric. So half of the work of morphometrics comes before any statistics, just in the reduction of forms to something that look like numbers. And this could have all been said in 1950, but in 1950 there wasn't an alternative. And here in 2016 there is an alternative, which is the genomic description of the same organism. And that is the true revolution that Joe and I have spanned in our careers. When we were undergraduates, genomics was probably not part of the curriculum yet, or if it was, it was just a promise.
It didn't have that name.
Oh. Yeah, but you were an undergraduate. I was an undergraduate starting in 63. You were an undergraduate starting in maybe...
1960.
Watson and Crick's paper was 7 years out.
It had happened, and we were being told about it. It hadn't worked its way into all the textbooks.
Yeah. So this baby comes with a genome, and with possibly a sequence, possibly a complete genomic sequence, if its parents are rich or named Venter or something like that. And that information is absolutely brand new in our lifetimes. And that's the part of the struggle of morphometrics is the extension of old methods that could not possibly have imagined the new data sets. When we, in the 60s, talked about complicated data, this is what we meant by complicated. Lots and lots of pixels, or voxels, or maybe points from a brain. To have lots and lots of almost aligned base pairs, amino acids, that was inconceivable except in science fiction. And so the balance of data now, which goes toward genomics, is not matched by the balance of methods, certainly not the balance of classical methods, which are based on the older kind of information. And you are present, you as graduate students, are present at a time where the transition is continuing. It's moving into industry in ways that the academics are having a lot of trouble handling. Companies do much of this a great deal better than we do. 23 for you and me does better at sequencing than most academic sites can do. And we don't know where it's going to come out. Well, I'm speaking for myself. I don't know where it's going to come out. Do you? Where this will settle down in 2030 or 2040, where the division is between corporate and medical-based and academics?
Well, sequencing very clearly will become so cheap that it won't matter whether it's done by a corporation or a university. It'll be just something you could do for a few dollars,
mm-hmm, right?
For any specimen.
But using the information, I mean, figuring out how to combine the picture of that baby here with the sequence of its genome, we're nowhere near even formalizing that task. How do we relate a genome to a life? We just don't know, as statisticians, as biologists, as genomicists, if that's a word. That's for you as professors to think about. Anyway, that's the first kind of formalism, the individual organism, and maybe there's a genome attached. And this is the second kind of formalism, the explicit comparison of two somethings. And it will turn out in morphometrics that these are kept substantially different, even though they're based on the same information. This is a landmark data set. We've hinted it to you several times already what that is, and we'll be talking about it ad nauseam for the rest of the course. There are 20 landmark points in here and 74 semi-landmarks. Here are some positions of those points. Here are some different positions of those points. This is a Homo sapiens from the Vienna Museum. This is, I think, an Australopithecus. And this thing, the thing that arose in the middle, is the transformation from the left to the right. So formally, it's the comparison between two objects. It's like a distance, but it's a vector, not a number. And graphically, it takes us back 500 years, we'll see in just another few pages, to the foundation of representational portraiture, which is not usually considered part of biology. Renaissance painting, it turns out that was anticipated by Albrecht Dürer, the great German woodcutter of the second decade of the 16th century. So this idea is about 500 years old. It's certainly older than biology as a science. This particular representation is mine, the thin plate spline, which is the subject of section 5.5 here, and is probably it's my most cited contribution to biology, the way the method of contrast is just most cited contribution to biology. But A, it didn't start as biology. It started as computer graphics for animation, really, and we'll go over that. So the first appearance of this mathematics was in journals of straight computer vision and computer art. And second, what it appeals to is the retinal processing of those pictures. It's using your function as a binocular primate, not your function as a biologist. It's sort of like a contour map in that you could have been reading this 500 years ago and getting it right. Albrecht Dürer was trying to draw these 500 years ago, and there wasn't any statistics. It hasn't been invented. So those are the two main kinds of formalisms we're going to be driving to. And they're different, even if they're based on the same information. As I said, if this is one set of reference points, they're not drawn, and this, which is drawn, is the other set of reference points, then this is just a picture somehow of the vector between them. But the art here is entirely in that word somehow. It's a very unusually useful picture of a vector. And the third and last computer exercise for me, which I'd meant to get ready for in Vienna but didn't have the time for, so I'll do it this weekend. Third and last exercise will be simple R software that produces this picture. Everything else is up to you. Okay. So that's figures 5.1 and 5.2. Everything we talked about before in chapters 2 and 3 were like the first picture. They were about quantifications that were measures of extent of the individual form, length, weight, volume, circumference, things like that. And the tools there were regressions and correlations and analyses of covariance and stuff like that, and were tools designed for application to things like numbers. These instead are a different kind of picture for which tools like correlation and regression require some work to apply. So that, for instance, when we end up talking about the regression of one of these things, it will have been computed by taking each of these coordinates separately, regressing it on whatever is supposed to be predicted, and then drawing the effect of increasing the predictor value by 1 on all of those regressions at the same time, and dragging this grid around according to that prediction. So this is a complicated process, but visually it goes as fast as your hand can slide a slider in the packages. You just say, how much of this factor do you want? 1, 2, 2.5, 2.63. Slide the slider to there, and you get the regression as a basic cognitive perception. And normally regression doesn't do that. Moving around a slider on a linear regression isn't something you normally do in a package. Moving around a slider on a shape regression is more or less the only way of understanding the shape regression. So even where we use standard statistical tools, we're using them with sort of with a different human-computer interface than people used for biometrics taken 1 point. Okay. I'm sorry. I just have to take that. Okay. So keep in mind, first, that if you haven't seen this before, your intuition isn't ready for it yet. We'll be playing with it. But second, that I'm assuring you, and Joe's assuring you in advance, it's worth it. Okay. So we start by going backward through history. This is a general overview of what's in the chapter. What today's lecture is about is this injection, incursion of ideas from pictorial representation. And most of the time, a lecture like this will start with Darcy Thompson, who was the first person to put this sort of thing into a book about biology. But he was really so eccentric in his intellectual setup that it's safer to more or less avoid his examples. But it started a lot earlier than him. That's section 5.1. What's important is that when we talk about how landmarks correspond, the word correspondence there isn't just the notion of homology. It's not only the biologist's idea of correspondence, but it's also all of these earlier cultural contributions. We'll get pictures from caricature. We'll get pictures from simple surface scanning of celebrities. We'll get pictures from all over the place that don't necessarily have any biology and still are susceptible to the same kind of processing. Embryology would be great, except most of our models don't actually work for embryos. They can't make something from nothing, and embryos basically come from nothing. This stuff is old. It's Paleolithic in the literal sense sometimes. That was section 5.1. Section 5.2, which is Thursday's lecture, is the first pair of descriptors of, in this case, it'll be a set of 3 points. And this will already be different enough from what you do with a ruler on 2 points, or what you do with a protractor on 3 points, that I wrote a whole book about it back in 1990. The morphometrics of 3 points is nothing like the measurement of the sides of the triangle and the angles of the triangle that you would think of in terms of extents. That's the safest way here to talk about why we have a section 5.2. We do different things than a ruler does, different things that a protractor does. Namely, we're selecting descriptors. And rulers don't do that. 5.2. 5.3, oh, and we'll also have our first set of shape coordinates. 5.3 introduces an important notion, Prokrusty's distance, which is not a genomic distance. It has entirely different theorems and properties, but it is a distance. Meets the assumptions it's zero for a form against itself, and it's bigger than zero for forms that are different, and things like that. And they will be analyzable by one of the multivariate things in Chapter 4. And this connection, which is the fundamental connection between classic multivariate statistics and the modern morphometric formalism, is the subject of another lecture of its own. Figure out what date that is. That's the lecture. Oh, okay, that's also the same date, November 10th, the Prokrusty's distance lecture. But the main reason for having Chapter 4 is so that you can do some multivariate statistics on sets of landmark locations. Joe's and my current research is trying to make those statistics better, but the changes are not fundamental. Section 5.5 is a thin plate spline, and section 5.6 concludes all of our running examples from the whole chapter by applying a riot of different kinds of multivariate statistics to the objects that are being drawn. And then there's a last day of class where I say, you've now learned the Torah standing on one foot. You can now put the other foot down and go with God. So we start then by focusing in on the logical problem here, which is anatomical variability. And this is something that the classic anatomists had a lot of trouble with, because they kept on trying to divide the world into categories, normal versus abnormal, or humans versus chimpanzees. The idea of variability fights with the purpose of biology ever since Plato and Aristotle, to divide the world into natural kinds. We'll know the phrase, cut nature at the joints. It's from Aristotle, literally. It's not how you do 20th century biology, but it's how you recognize kinds of cats, or the difference between a cat and a dog, or the difference between kinds of trees. You are a natural historian, i.e. doing natural history, and you do not naturally do anatomical variability very well at all. Three or four hundred years ago, you would have had to be better at this if you were a farmer. You would have had to understand the difference between yields in wet years and dry years, the difference that putting this kind of manure versus that kind of manure, this much manure versus that much manure on your field made. The places where this first had to be done right are basically agricultural. And you also know about anatomical variability by looking at the range of human forms. I only learned a little while ago that among the 613 blessings that the Orthodox Jew is supposed to keep in mind for all occasions, there's a blessing to be spoken when you see a cripple. And the blessing is, in translation, "Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, who hast created so many interesting kinds of persons," so many interesting kinds of creatures. Kinds of creatures. So, in this classical liturgy, the instance was already classified. And you see this as well in South African apartheid. Every living human had to be classified into one of, I think it was, four racial groups. And this was vicious. And my anthropology department back in Vienna, during the Nazi period, was legally responsible for the Aryanization certificates for the city of Vienna. So my department legally condemned, let us say, several thousand people to their deaths during the war years. And the last person who was a faculty member during that period retired in 1999. There is a history here that has not yet been written. Anyhow, anatomical variability is a new notion when treated as a foundation for biology. We will be using the variability only of pictures that look like this. And there's just not much information in there compared to the stuff we had here, which had gray level and texture and lots of little pieces of information. This is just coordinates. XY pairs if we're in 2D, XYZ triples if we're in 3D. Could I? I need some more water here.
Here, give it to me.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, maybe I'll give you something that doesn't have saliva on it. Just fill it up. Thanks. This is actually the data set that was used for that figure 5.2. Right? This is figure 5.3. If any of you were following along. Are any of you following along in this text, by the way? I'm trying to go in page order. No, if you're not now, when you find yourself at leisure, go back, and this is the way to review it, by seeing the text context. So this is 94 points, 20 of which have names that are usually in Latin. They're there on the next page. So the names are things like canalis opticus intersection, or foramen cecum, or fossa incisiva. Those clearly aren't English. And they are actually located at the center of the text here, where you'd expect to find them, external and internal for points that are paired. And then the stuff in between are called semi-landmarks, and they're ways of handling curving information, and we'll talk about them in section 5.5. To put a date on this stuff, semi-landmarks came into morphometrics with a paper of mine in 1997. So these are less than 20 years old now. The reason they came in is that they required nothing new in the way of formalisms. It turns out that everything you could do for landmark points, you could do for these as well. And so these came for free. If they hadn't been free, it would have been a lot of work. Thank you, Joe. You should keep me hydrated for the next hour or so. But you can see first that this omits a lot of the words, the name points, skip a lot of stuff. This is a human head, right, in its mid-sagittal section. So this, from here to here, is the forehead boss, and there's just nothing on the forehead that gets two coordinates over this whole range. And if you go the whole 180 degree of the forehead, from the brow ridge, glabella, all the way back here to lambda, which is, well, actually, this is inion, the point I'm pointing to now. This is lambda back here. It's a triple point. This whole range only has the one landmark on it, Bregma. And there's a joke here because the majority of people don't have a good Bregma. They will have a triangle where there should be a point. These are called Vermian bones. And for babies, there isn't any Bregma. It's just an opening. It has to be filled in. So this point is great for fossils and really terrible for living children. Plus, it's hard to see on the X-ray. So there's just a lot of information missing here if you care about the bones covering the brain. And we're still struggling with the problem of how to handle all of this information, half of the circumference of the head. By contrast, we're very good down here with all of those points that come from bones that have corners on them. The real problem with this is that the form is smooth. It doesn't really have any biomechanical function except holding the brain together and protecting it. Most bones have lots more information locally than this part of the skull does. The biologist knows this, and if you've taken a course in craniofacial anatomy, you'd recognize it. The statistician just has to struggle with it throughout. That there are parts of forms that just don't give you the information you need to treat them evenly, fairly. That is the statistician's problem. The biologist is doing the best he or she can. The form isn't cooperating with these methods. It's also the case, by the way, if you try doing the modeling of the inside, the brain, the human cortex, it is just as difficult, even more. So the brain has hardly any landmark points. The structure in here, where I'm moving my mouse, is a branching graph like cauliflower of the white matter. Almost impossible to quantify today, in 2016, there are still no good quantifications of the human cortex as a 3D structure. This is remarkable. And the people who do brain imaging are struggling even to show such simple effects as your Alzheimer's gets worse, your brain should be thinning. Is it thinning evenly or unevenly? We don't have answers to that question yet because we can't agree on what numbers we should be using to measure thinning. And it's 2016. So this is remarkably little information. 94 points have, 20 landmarks have 40 coordinates, and there's probably another 74 coordinates here. You'll understand what I'm saying in a little while. So that's 114 functional degrees of freedom for an image that took, in 2D, 65K pixels to draw. And in 3D, this is about 8 megabytes of data.
from which you pick the same roughly 20 or 30 or 40 points. Now it's 120 coordinates out of 6 million. You pause there and say, genomics, in principle, is talking about all 6 million. Morphometrics is talking about a carefully selected 120 because its subject is anatomical variability, and this is the state of the methods at present. They also have this amazingly long figure caption explaining operationally what each of the, how each of those points is defined. And you have to do that, and it's very hard. And at the moment, it is not quite possible yet to train programs to do this correctly. They're almost there with machine learning, but not quite. So the landmark points are concentrating information about the outcome of biological processes. They have been put there by morphogenetic, selective, or ecophenotypic mechanisms. Moving a landmark isn't a causal manipulation the way changing a predictor in a multiple regression was. If it is, we're doing biomechanics. And muscles do things. Landmarks by themselves don't usually do things. And evolutionarily, all bets are off. So we have to come to terms with what we as biologists mean by anatomy in order to realize what is being skipped, omitted, just flatly omitted in the morphometric definitions, out of necessity. Here's something from Gray's Anatomy. So this figure is, what, 150 years old? This is the optic cup, your blind spot, viewed in vertical section. There's a nerve coming out of there, the optic nerve. It's big in this blow-up. It has a central artery, blood supply. It penetrates the retina here at a little gap. The retina has several layers which are being drawn. And this is an example of one of those figures where there is so much less usable information about variability that it's almost inconceivable how much you have to simplify to get down to something that's going to be capable of numbers. So lots and lots of information in this drawing. It really does look like a good biological image, right? That's about 1870. This is, I think, 1970. It's in color. It's a little bit simplified, but mostly it's been changed because this one's in 3D. So there's a section here of the fascicles of that nerve, as well as the little bit of the enhanced drawing of how those parts of the retina are coming in, little sketch of the retinal texture here, omitting all of the retinal cells, more drawing there. And it's also more asymmetric, as this picture notes. This is a pretty symmetric figure. This one is realistically asymmetric. But the way the morphometrics of this area is going now, and this is current work, not mine, out of Portland, Oregon, work in progress, is to take all of that junk, go back to the original pictures, build them into a sort of pie, so there's a slice, I think it's every 2 degrees, all the way around the whole circle. So this is one slice of a cylinder, and then put it back in 3D as the following very simple geometry. We have an axis. Is my mouse in here? Yeah. We have an axis kind of looking like the main drag of these hyperboloids here. And we have a retinal plane with respect to which they're almost but not quite perpendicular. And then we have a concentric system of layers that are boundaries between tissues. So from this picture, all that remains are the surfaces between those structures in reduced detail, but drawn in full 3D. So we don't actually, as anatomists, we don't have a canonical section with which to guarantee this picture. This isn't horizontal on the retina because, well, the eyeball is a ball. And there's nothing unusual about the horizontal on the retina. Nothing about its wiring, nothing about its anatomy, nor the vertical. The optic nerve pit here, the blind spot, doesn't have a natural vertical or horizontal. That's in the brain. So this has to be done in 3D if you're going to be talking about variability. And what you see is the things that you use to talk about variability are going to be quite few. They're going to be the geometry of that. Now, this is okay because the main reason for studying this variability is one human disease, glaucoma. And glaucoma changes that geometry. This wasn't a discovery. This was a precondition of funding the research. That nobody was doing this to optic cups until the National Eye Institute noticed that if you could follow that geometry without surgery by taking pictures from the outside of the eye, optical computed tomography, you could measure the progression of glaucoma in terms of the bending, the cupping of this cup, without injuring the eye. You could follow it. And also other diseases, there's a retinal disease, macular degeneration, likewise can be followed to some extent by following the geometry of this. But there are enormous trade-offs here in the focus on small detail, and even, well, this is mesoscale, we're not at the cellular level yet, but this is an important part of anatomical variability because it's associated with the disease. It would be unlikely that this geometry by itself would arise in an evolutionary context, because you can't see it on fossils, for instance. It can only be comparisons of extant species. And there are probably papers about the fine structure of the retina of the primates or the anthropoids. I haven't checked this, but they would not necessarily be using our kind of morphometrics at all. They might be using textures, spacings of the rods and cones, classical morphometry, other things. So if you try to take these methods for landmarks and drive them down to small scale, they are not guaranteed to work. This remains a sort of experimental field which is designed instead to respond to other kinds of input. And the next few figures that I want to review for you are those kinds of input, which aren't from anatomy. As I hinted already, some of them are from portraiture. This is a classic. You recognize this as called Venus on the half shell when you get her in art history. Where is that image here? Venus. There we go. It's, where is she? I'm sorry, I got the wrong Venus.
Top 6 inches.
This one? Okay, yeah, that's her. Venus on the half shell. Oh, here we go. Yeah. This one. That's what I thought I typed. Anyway, this is from 1450. What year are we? But that's that lady being used as the cover of a textbook on face measurement for dentists. How you fix your patient to look like this. And you see the dots that the painter might have used but probably didn't use because he was just a Renaissance painter. But these are soft tissue landmarks, which are an invention of the anthropometrist of the 20th century, points on the face that correspond to various kinds of comparisons that we're already making. Width of the nose, heights of the lip, width of the lip, separation of the eyes. These are things that portraitists have known about for a long time. Get to that figure
I should say that the picture, the painting, is in the Uffizi Gallery in Florence.
Yes.
And when I saw it, I couldn't think of anything except Adobe.
You actually walked up to it with a ruler until the guards restrained you?
No, when I saw the painting, I couldn't think of... All I could think of was its use in Adobe software as a logo.
Oh, okay. Well, did it have the dots?
I'm looking at the painting of the Adobe logo.
Oh, that's great. I see. So it sounds like a cause and effect reversal here, but in any case, the original doesn't have those dots on it. Right?
Yeah, it's true.
Good. I'm glad. At least it didn't when I was there. Now, this is useful, but the current systems that do face recognition don't do that at all. They don't look for facial landmarks. There's a computer program out there from Facebook, unfortunately, that you send it a snapshot of a celebrity, and it will tell you with high accuracy which celebrity it is, just by taking a bunch of points on the snapshot and matching them to a bunch of points on the 2,000 snapshots of that celebrity they've already got. This is not so far from systematic biology. A friend of ours, Norman McLeod, who just retired as the head of invertebrates at the National Museum in London, has computer programs that do this for insect wings and is better at identifying insects, and also does this for spiral forms, microforaminifera, is better at doing that than humans are. Just by throwing sets of points on a system and following machine learning algorithms. No Hennigian principles need apply, and no morphometrics in the landmark sense is being used. The classifications are essentially correct. So that's already a shot across the bow of the applications of this for, well, classification. That we can do better with classification by not trying to be anatomists, but just trying to sort pictures into piles. If that's what the scientists did originally, if the species look like they have differences. To Richard Raymond, any pair of species look different. There are cryptic species that actually don't look different, but appear at different times of the year, can't do those. But this is, in effect, an elimination of one logical attempt to use this from pictures if your goal is classification. My personal goal is understanding rather than classification. And it starts, again, you can go back. This creature is 25,000 years old. If you haven't seen her, it's quite magnificent. She's this big, really. Stands 4 inches high in her own room in the Museum of Natural History in Vienna. The Venus of Willendorf was discovered in 1908, so this isn't that long. And what's remarkable about this, of course, is that this is a caricature. This isn't quite within the normal anatomical range. It's obvious this is a representation of female fertility, obvious partly because there isn't even a face on this creature. It is a female. It has a vulva, rich milk-filled breasts, lots of fat to get through the winter, a hairdo, so perhaps a queen, a princess. No apparent feet. But this theme came into portraiture as early as anything we're going to borrow. This is Leonardo da Vinci more than 500 years ago, and he played a lot with non-existent anatomy. That Venus on the half shell that we had a few pages back could have been a particularly beautiful Florence model. At least the rumor is that Andrea della Robbia was using his own mistress as model for a lot of these. But these were not actual living Italians. As far as we know, they were going to have a lot of trouble chewing their food, for instance. But this really is Da Vinci. And in each of these cases, you can see this is an extreme amount of normal variation taken past the normal range so that we can see what is varying. And that's the clearer analog to what morphometrics is doing.
Morphometrics is going to be looking for the underlying features of variation and pulling them out separately because they are size change or shape dimensions or the effects of a fin factor, pulling them out separately so that you can think of them once again like the biologist you are and interpret them in terms of understanding variation of form, why this fish needs this big a fin, because it's in a windy part of the ocean perhaps. So Da Vinci was doing this at the same time, about 1500, that Albrecht Dürer was saying, why don't you use grids? He said, oops, so let me make that a little smaller. Why don't you use grids? And he wasn't using curving grids only because he hadn't thought of them. So he instead was using straight line grids. Projective geometry had not been invented yet in 2D, only in 3D. It only worked for lines. Analytic geometry still had 100 years to go. But this is real Dürer now talking about probably the extreme range of real human variation. And this is from a book of his called, in German, Human Proportions. So we have a tie already between the modern notion of proportions, which are numbers, and Dürer, who was a portraitist, using the same language, humanen proportionen, the same in German, to refer to the range of things he has to draw, which are the range of things you have to sort, or the range of things within a species, and by extension between species, that you have to use to talk about evolution. These, as I say, were roughly realistic. Go cut forward a couple hundred years, and you get to Daumier, who's just outside the ranges of realism, forms that didn't quite exist but are recognizable as individual French politicians. This one in the middle, this thing that looks like a pear, is the king. You were not allowed to draw the king. You could only draw the pear. It was illegal to draw the actual shape of the face of Louis XVIII, which was remarkably pear-shaped. He looked like the actor John Goodman, if you know John Goodman, just all jowls, no forehead. That's why there's the slightest sketch of human features on that. But this was a recognizable politician, but the nose wasn't that long. And recognizable politician, but the facial angle wasn't that negative. And so forth for all of these. So this is caricature. And at the same time, the anthropologists were just starting making their invidious comparisons between species. This is a book called Phrenology, 1760. This is the first printed appearance of the thing that for 150 years was called the Camper angle. This is a drawing in a book by somebody, Camper, attempting to show the great chain of being from chimpanzees, somewhat exaggerated down here, through, unfortunately, Africans to, I think this is Southern Europeans and then Northern Europeans. And the angle gets steadily straighter as you go on. Now, this is an angle. It's a number. And it's being used to represent a dimension of variability. One dimension, multiple specimens. This is an innovation. Back here, each of these is a different dimension. And in morphometrics, it was only around the turn of the present century that we learned the language for talking clearly about lots of different directions in shape space at the same time. But as we went forward there, suddenly we're talking about identifying dimensions in advance and using them either for political purposes if we're corrupt or for scientific purposes if we're not. We'll be talking throughout the rest of this chapter about examples of growth, examples of ecophenotypy, examples of size allometry. I think there's also some other kinds of examples going. If they're not in the text, then they're in my slide collection. But the idea of doing this like a biologist affected the morphometrics by the emphasis on individual dimensions that are now not individual lengths or individual angles, but in some way that hasn't yet been quantified as of 1900, individual patterns that are going to get implemented somehow. So each of these is a dimension of analysis, and current morphometrics is a way of sorting those dimensions for the things that are important to the biologist. Well, dimension's a metaphor. It's like a distance on the blackboard. It's something that in analytic geometry since 1600 is like squares on graph paper. And it's worth pausing right here at the beginning, and if any of you are following, I'm on page 17 going forward, to talk about where these models just don't work. They didn't work for the raw data of the eyeball in detail, the retinal example there. There's too much information. But here are cases where there's just not that much information, and they still don't work. And this is from an unusual anatomy textbook. It's one called An Atlas of Human Anatomy by Brian Anson, 1950. That's a long time ago, 1950, but it's an unusual book in that it has page after page of normal variation. Most anatomy textbooks don't do this. We had the greatest living anatomist here at Washington until recently. He's still living, he's just not here anymore, Cornelius Ross. He's in well-deserved retirement now. But his idea of anatomy was there's one human anatomy atlas, and it's called the Foundational Model of Anatomy, the FMA. He produced it with the aid of a couple of friends of mine. And there's one standard form. And if you don't have it, you're abnormal. But these are all patterns of aortic arch branching that you get in 5% or more of, I think it was 500 people he dissected during his career as the anatomy lecturer at Johns Hopkins, something like that. And our morphometric methods cannot cope with this. We don't have a language for differences of branching structure. This is ironic, since cephalogeny is a branching structure, but you can think of these as something like three-dimensional phylogenies, and we can't do them. Not yet, not with landmarks. We just have to call them categories. So it's as if each phylogeny was its own Darwinian realm. I don't mean that there's an analogy between phylogenies and these in terms of their scientific use. I saw Joe frowning just now because I hit him with this idea without preparation. But these are branching structures. And while we can sort of talk about them as embryological developments, we can talk about what popped up first, what popped up later. Maybe that's the analog. We can't talk about them as static patterns of anatomy. We just don't have the language. And this also applies to anything else in the body that's branching. The bronchi in the lungs, the fascia of the biceps, or the quadriceps. They're called that because the biceps has two heads, the quadriceps has four. They're branching. They come in different orders. There's the way the nerves weave in and out of those muscles. There's topology, topological branching. Have an example of that coming in other pages further. So if this is what you're interested in, morphometrics, the way we teach it, probably isn't going to help you. It'll go on frustrating you by saying, well, we can't handle weaving patterns yet, or maybe ever. We can't do this. While we're at it, I can't do the intestines. They just wander through the abdomen in ways that the body knows perfectly well. The embryo knows perfectly well. The morphometrician can't handle it at all, except to say, well, I can model this as a tube 40 feet long with a radial coordinate system, but I can't tell you where it is in 3D. That's the surgeon's problem. So we can't do that one. This is another plate from Anson. We can't do this much anatomical variation. Those things on the left there are a bunch of, I think it's 21 normal stomachs. the morphometrics of those are as bad as the morphometrics of handwritten numbers, which is actually something that people do, because the post office needs morphometrics. It needs to read a handwritten three, and those are things analyzed, if at all, like handwritten digits. We can't talk about landmarks on them. They have a couple of landmarks. Each one has an esophagus coming in and a duodenum coming out, but that's not enough. And the stuff in the middle just doesn't work. And livers look a little bit better. At least livers usually have lobes. But the variation of shape here, again, is so enormous, it's as great or greater than the variation of skull shape on all of the mammals, including the cetaceans. An old friend, a dead friend of mine, now dead, Les Marcus, did an analysis of the skulls of all the mammals. And the cetaceans are unusual because the nostril moves from here to here. That's a lot of morphometric variation. You can still do it by Procrustes' methods, and this is more variation than that. And this is just within the adults of one species. It's
so,
a form
so
that's
one
not
of
regulated.
Your, one of your lessons is you're not going to tell everybody how to solve all problems. There's some morphometric problems that are still out there even after you finish the course.
True. I would phrase it rather in the opposite, that you will want to find the part of your question that can be handled morphometrically. And if your concern is in the study of human variation, human evolution, you do morphometrics one way. And if your concern is in the study of the evolution of, let's say, ants, the social insects, E.O. Wilson's other example, you probably do your morphometrics another way. Using segmented organisms are going to be handled differently than rigid bodies. You want to adapt your morphometrics to the question. There's one more of these examples. I'm on page 21 now. Two more of these examples, actually. The one on the left here shows the distribution of the end of the spinal cord on the spinal column for that same 200 or 500 examples. So it's kind of a bell curve, close enough for this course, and some people, some normal people, have the spinal cord ending here, and some normal people have the spinal cord ending three vertebrae further down. And this should matter to you if you're a neurosurgeon, because the nerves come out sort of in order, and if there's no spinal cord here, there's no nerve coming out. So if you think of this as a landmark at the end of the spinal cord and a landmark somewhere down the vertebral column, these things don't fit our model of continuous deformation, which is in the text somewhere where I skipped over it. You can still measure the length of the spinal cord, and you can measure the length of the spinal column, and you can subtract, which is what we're doing here, but there's no way to do a thin plate spline. In this case, the statistics will work, but the graphics won't. And sometimes the statistics themselves won't work, like those attempts to do landmarks of Gray's Anatomy drawings. And sometimes the graphics will work and show you patterns of things like allometry or evolutionary gradients. But all of these are formalisms that are making enormous non-biological demands on data. Here's a very nice example published quite recently. This is from 1950. This is from 2009, in a proceedings volume that I edited. It's a picture from Charles Oxnard and Paul O'Higgins of what changed in the relation of the muscles to the skull in this section, coronal. Mid coronal section between gorilla and human infant, and some muscles went this way on the surface of the bone. Some things converged here on the next layer, which is the outer layer. This moved down for the gorilla, it's a lot bigger. Sorry, moved down for the infant, it's a lot lower. And the sagittal crest, of course, just went away for the child. So if you want to draw what's happened between the adult male gorilla with his wonderful crest up the top and the human infant, the one we started with in figure one, that picture isn't a deformation. It's a much more extensive rearrangement that requires knowing all of this stuff
which you learn as a comparative anatomist or by reading Charles Oxnard. But this hand-drawn figure is better than anything that our current programs can put on a data set, because it understands what the parts are that have to be kept separate.
So what you're seeing there,
I just want to understand.
Okay.
So it's the bone.
Yeah, that's the skull.
This layer is the bone. This layer is giving you a representation of what the muscles are doing.
That's probably that could very well be the blood vessels, and then this would be the muscles. Right? There are three layers.
Let me just try
to read it. All landmarks with the same position of the landmarks in sequence.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to go back to the reference and figure out what those three layers are. I thought I'd include it in my figure caption. So bony skull versus superficial musculature, and the question is, what's this in the middle? I think it's blood vessels. Surface blood vessels, I'm not sure. It says there are two shells, but actually there are three shells drawn. Someone should have noticed that before. This caption reads, along the two shells, and there are three shells. This is not helpful. But I'll fix that. Okay. Yeah.
On figure 514.
Figure 514? The previous figure? Sure.
The variation is of magnitude 2 R. Is there a way for you to know that your geometric morphometrics won't work beforehand, or do you just have to do it?
If you can try putting landmarks on these things, and it turns out that there's a dimensionless quantity called something like Procrustes diameter, the name isn't standardized, and the maximum possible is pi halves. That's why it's not intuitive. The pi is the circumference of the circle. And anything bigger than about 0.5 is too much for any of our standard methods. And this diameter is about 0.9. The diameter for the weight for the mammal skulls, I think, was 0.66.
So you can put what you're calling, but we'll talk about later, semi-landmarks here.
The semi-landmarks don't work either. What does work for this is straight machine learning, which doesn't know any biology at all, isn't using landmarks. It's saying, you give me a class of livers like normals and another class of livers like abnormals, and the computer will find the features, the characters that best discriminate these classes.
What I was saying is that you could put semi-landmarks on these.
It doesn't help.
Well, and then you find that it's too chaotic to analyze in some sense.
It's nowhere near the linear realm. It's something we talked about some years ago. It's just these metrics are bending too much in their Riemannian manifold. Sorry for that language. But that's what happens also when you try to do this in the solid brain of humans. There's just too much variation for any of our linear approximations to be even remotely realistic. The idea of principal components doesn't work anymore for variation consistent with the adult human brain. Principal components doesn't work for these if you're using landmarks. It sort of works if you're using grayscale images and normalizing them softly, just sort of trying to put this in the middle. Put that division in the average. I don't know what to do with the extra load there. But yeah, if this is what you're looking at, then either try to find a question that has less variation, or don't expect the landmarks to give you a stable answer. Different sets of landmarks will give you substantially different answers. Coming up for the rest of this, my part of the course, will be examples where it does work. And the examples that I've chosen here in Chapter 5 are all examples where it works. This is the only part where it doesn't. So I was, for my last 10 minutes here, I want to talk about the history of how this came to be useful anyway. And it's mostly a bunch of very stubborn German-speaking anatomists around the start of the 20th century saying human skulls and our intuitive notions of racial differences, which are, of course, perverse, our notions of the superiority of Europeans, all the rest of that stuff, can be converted to these. And anthropology was the field where this was done first. So this is pages from the standard textbook of anthropology from 1914. I have two copies. Here's a view from the outside. Notice the predominance of curves over landmarks, by the way. A view from the front. Rudolf Martin here had 68 points. That's a reasonable number of landmarks. Not 1,000. He also almost had semi-landmarks, not quite. And his system of generating points from curves turns out to be interesting, but we don't have time to talk about it here. If anybody is doing that, if anybody in the class is doing analysis of data starting with 3D representations, e.g. from CT or from surface photography, and getting landmarks from that, it's usually good if you first get curves, and it's worth your reading this part of the handout, but we can skip it for most of you. But that kind of picture, which was turn of the 20th century, turns into this, which is essentially from current orthodontic textbooks. The representation of an orthodontic patient is still a set of points taken from curves, taken from a regulated medical image. A photograph from the side or from the front, or an x-ray from the side or from the front, or a CT scan. So they kind of guessed right about the relative variability of the human skull as an unusually fit organism or organ. Notice the total absence of landmarks up here. It's not just that the orthodontist doesn't use them, it's that there aren't any. From that, then...
Sorry, can I say, how do they define points? So, like, on this one, 1, 2, 3, on the chin.
Each of those has an operational definition that I have in another file.
Is it some sort of curvature base or something?
Some of them are curvature base. Let me bring that up.
It just seems like on the skull you should be able to see,
most of those don't exist on the skull. That's a problem. It's a good enough question for me to interrupt myself here. Let's see. This is the book. Hello, I know you're there. Notice the book is typed. I'm just trying to go through. I'm just looking for my... Okay, that's... Okay. So there are some standard planes, which are straight lines. So here are, they're called planes, but they're lines. So there they are. And then each point has a definition like this. There are 49 of those points, so there are 49 of these definitions. Most of them presume a coordinate system. So Menton is the bottom point on some outline. And so you need to know which way is up. We don't do that anymore. But it's the best they could do. Up was, how was up defined this way? Oh, up is defined by the axis between orbitale, which does not exist on the skull, and acoustic meatus, which does not exist on the skull. Because orbitale is the flat part of the orbital rim, and it's a curve, not a point. And acoustic meatus isn't a point. It's the middle of the ear hole, and depends on how big your finger is. So this line, number 3, doesn't exist. But the orthodontist thinks it does. I'm not being snide. I was on this project. This was the best we could do. Some of the definitions are sheer chaos. If there is no curvature here and you can't do it this way, do it this way, it says. And then no one has ever understood this definition, which is Franz van der Linden's definition of L. No one else could find that point, and it isn't used anymore. But here's that picture. So this is the same picture. I'd be glad to talk with you about this later, but I'm going to sort of finish the lecture. So, yeah, each point has an extremely delicate operational definition there. Okay. I'll look at the echo. Right. So from those points, then, what the early 20th century did is what the orthodontist still does. You just compute indices. Angles and ratios. And here in the same book, 1914, are a selection from his, I think it was 600 different angles and ratios. He just threw in everything that anybody had ever used and then told you what the standard subgroups were that people had been using to classify types. I can't read that up here. We've got human range from uricranial, mesouricranial, and stenocranial. That's based on something by Torok, 1888, or ultrabrachystenocephal, hyperbrachystenocephal for a particular ratio. And these are obviously arbitrary because they look like gasoline prices. But this is the main textbook of anthropology for 50 years. So this is what people did to classify. And then, and I'm almost done here, if you were interested in species like humans versus Neanderthals, you'd pick some of those and throw your data into that tabulation. So here's a list of measures taken arbitrarily, and here's their values for his Neanderthal, and here's another colony of Neanderthals, and here are recent Europeans, and here's somebody else's Neanderthal. And the conclusion, well, as it says here in German, this is a comparison. It just shows us that this skull is a Neanderthal. So it's a classification issue. And here's another table from the same book. This was the first great book on Neanderthals using the standard method. I'll stop here. We're about two or three figures from the end of the chapter rather than trying to push it. But the main points here, the take-home points, are that, well, we can get to that, right? There's no real overlap here with the tape of the bullets in the next section. We'll do that tomorrow. But here's take-home. Geometric morphometry, let me make that bigger. Again, you all have this on the website. We're using algebra, we're using geometry, we're using statistics, and we're using the knowledge base of comparative anatomy, the terminology of comparative anatomy, the history of art, including ancient prehistoric art, the visual psychology of caricature. We're throwing a lot of stuff in here that is not normally part of biology. When you do Evo Devo, you don't use Albrecht Dürer. We don't use Leonardo da Vinci's caricatures to study the embryology of Hydra. We are using Leonardo da Vinci's caricatures to understand something about these methods. The anatomical structures that are best suited here are those that vary in extent, not in presence, absence, meristic, seriation, or topology, and for which you can ignore histology, except where it underlies anatomical boundaries. If there's really texture information, like the spacing of rods and cones, we don't handle it. The biology is the biology of the points is the biology of the curves and surfaces, and then we're getting to this. Originally, the G of geometric morphometrics was limited to distances, 2 points, or angles, 3 points. That was in 1900. And geometric morphometrics starts with the replacement of distances and angles by a single derived geometric quantity. It's actually a tensor, which permits the conversion of that into useful statistics. And that will be our main subject Thursday. And this is a good place to stop because I'm just losing my voice. It's over to you for a couple of minutes if you want. You haven't objected much.
I'm saving up my objections, so there'll be more objections later on. But I'm glad people are starting to interject.
Interject, object, subject, project, conject.
So far, you've done a lot of telling us about what doesn't work.
Well, no, but in sections 2 and 3, chapter 4, which I skipped over, but we'll go back to, there are a lot of good worked examples. But they tend to come from skulls and things like that, rigid objects.
Stop recording.